Yeah, Father. Show me where I'm wrong. Make it better the next time.
Father, just a question on communion services. Do you think communion services contribute to this erosion of understanding of sacrifice and that nothing is done to the thing? And what is your understanding of communion services, and what do you think the church understands how they should be applied?
Well, it's clear, of course. I mean, the people need to be instructed that the participation in the sacrifice is not accomplished by the reception of Holy Communion alone. And as all of you know, I'm sure, the fact that the Eucharist is brought to people where no priest, no sacrificing priest is available, is a provision that the Church makes for evangelization, not for retro evangelization. That is to say, where no sacrificing priest may remain or stay or even enter, the Eucharist is sent from, as it were, the closest sacrificing priest. And this is what happens in the Eucharist being brought to people in the hospital and so forth. Now, the great danger, I think, as everyone knows here, and to the best of my knowledge in New England, I hope we're not at the point where this is chronic, this mentality is chronic, that the so-called communion service all too easily apes Luther's Formae Missae Communionis. I mean, that's exactly what without the pretext of anything having been done to the Eucharist. So to have a liturgy of the word and then have someone distribute communion is not a solution for anything other than, as I said, evangelization. Now that the Church allows it in all the different circumstances that you're aware of, and that bishops may choose to allow this for a particular reason that they judge to be opportune, anyone who has given it 10 seconds of thought realizes that those quote-unquote priestless celebrations need to be interpreted within the context of the priesthood. And in my, the students have heard me, I shouldn't be saying they've ordained 8 years, I shouldn't be calling. Anyways, so some of the priests who studied St. John's have heard me say that if there's the best way to do this without getting into long, complicated catechetical theological discussions is simply to instruct whoever it is, deacon, layperson, who conducts these ceremonies, is that inserted into either at the beginning, in the middle, or at the end, is a prayer that a priest be sent. That's the simplest way of doing it. There should be a prayer written that says, "Dear God, thank you for providing for us now in this way, but now please send a priest, raise up a priest, raise up young men to come and restore the Eucharistic sacrifice, which is what any community needs."
In fact, Redemptione Sacramentum says that very thing. Anytime we use extraordinary ministers, the document says it should be an opportunity for that prayer. So you're right in line with the church.
Thank you. Go ahead. Yeah.
But I do have another question. Yeah.
Somehow I'm not surprised, but go ahead.
You've mentioned many fine examples in there about how we've lost the meaning of the sacrifice of the Mass. But one that seems very evident to me is the idea in the last 40 years of the Mass ad populum rather than ad deum. The very fact that we're having Mass towards the people is going to diminish the symbolic aspect of the sacrificial nature of the Mass. And I was wondering if you'd given that much thought. And I'm reminded of Cardinal Medina Estevez's comments on this. And he was saying, it's wrong to think today that the primary offering of the Mass is to the people. The primary offering of the Mass is to God the Father, not to the people. And then, it's as long as we're facing the people, of course people are going to think the primary offering of the Mass is to them.
Well, the premise I agree with, of course. I mean, that should be made clear. But I personally, and I don't, I'm not prepared to argue the point. Personally, I do not believe that what Ecclesia de Eucharistia requires of us, also requires turning the altar around. I myself don't believe that. I believe, as a good Dominican, I think if the priest gets up and explains, preaches, this has to be preached. It has to be preached. And if he preaches, and if the liturgy is conducted as Redemption, I mean, Redemption Sacramentum, as you may know if you've looked at it, was very finely tooled to the Eucharistic theology that I'm talking about here. So all the what seemed like to some pastors perhaps as unimportant or insignificant details, in fact, all are geared to do the very thing that you're saying we should do. And but that has to be changed by preaching. Someone has to stand up and say, this is the sacrifice that saves the world, and that's the strong representational language with Calvary, and that this is not a celebration of our commitment one to another, or our feelings for one another, or our common purpose in the world. It simply is not. So it is not, and it certainly is not a shared meal that somehow creates, you know, the illusion of unity. But that, I mean, what you know, I wouldn't say this in many circumstances, but if you go back and look at the first edition of the Catechism, even Cardinal Schönborn, dear friend that he is, that I lived with him in Freiburg for 4 years, if you look, you'll see that when he cited whoever, I don't say Christoph did it, but when the editors cited the text from Trent in a footnote that treated of the Eucharistic sacrifice, the footnote stopped short of the very point you're making. They cut off the text, and in the Editio Typica, if you look, the same footnote has the fuller, has the complete text on that very point. The forgetfulness, the amnesia of sacrifice. Yeah.
Cardinal Ratzinger's book on the, I forget the title of the recent book on the Eucharist, toward the end, he goes at length of the importance of facing Christ in the Mass, and he said an immediate solution would be not to turn the altars around, but to put a crucifix on the altar. There's very visible, yeah, for the priest to focus on Christ.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to. I think I happen to know that Cardinal Ratzinger, you know, has that view. And there's a book that he reviewed by this Alcuin Reed that has gained considerable attention. To be honest with you, it was surprising to me. I always thought the cross had to be on the altar. It was only, I won't tell you who told me that no, it just has to be in the area someplace, because I can remember the first time. But so. Though, again, I don't want to comment on a field that's not my own, namely liturgical practice, and anything that seems sound and right, I'm for. Although, at this point, what needs to be done is from a pulpit, priests have to stand up and preach Ecclesia Dei Eucharistia in the very neuralgic points. That's, and to me, to me, no better way of doing it is to start off with a simple declarative sentence: at this altar, the Catholic priest immolates. And if people don't know what immolates mean, well, then you can talk, you can explain it to them. Yes, Father.
Two questions, Father. One, do you think the lack of reverence for the Blessed Sacrament can be tied into this idea, this concept that our people are gradually losing the appreciation for sacrifice? Because, as you can see, even like with the increase of broken marriages, that they're not willing to make a sacrifice, that they don't even want religion to be inconvenient. So if they're going to avoid inconvenience, they're certainly going to avoid sacrifice. So sacrifice is becoming such an alien idea that parallels the lack of reverence.
I think that's true.
And the second question I had, Father, was unfortunately, I've noticed in a number of priest gatherings, some priests, either because of they have an alcohol problem or they have celiac disease, they won't consume both elements. It's my understanding that then they're not completing the sacrifice by not partaking of both, and in that case, even though the other priests present make the sacrifice, that particular priest is not made, you know, he shouldn't be taking a mass stipend for that particular mass because he himself is not celebrated completely. Is that correct?
That is my own view. That is my own view. However, I've not been able to find anywhere, if anyone knows, a text that supports that. You know, you have the V, the problem is it's the V concomitantia and the V verborum. You have the power of concomitance, which is why you genuflect after the consecration of the bread. So the whole body, blood, soul, and divinity is in both species. And then you have the V sacramenti, or the V verborum, as it's called. And that's where the representation and the double consecration, this is my body, this is my blood. So my own view is that, and I think it has always been the case, first, which took considerable effort to get into Redemptionis Sacramentum, that the priest has to consecrate, has to consume the host that he consecrates. And you can go to cathedrals, you can go to priest funerals, and you find ciboria floating. I watch it, you know, floating down, and that's a rupture of the sacrificial character of the Eucharist. And it's an abuse, I think, that it's one of the first that should be, a stop should be put to. And then secondly, because he must consume that which he consecrates, he has to consume what he has consecrated in the double consecration, which is both the body and the blood, because the sacrifice is sacramentally represented in the separated body and blood. So that's my own view, but I would not, but that's Salvum Meliore Judicio. Well, you can go, it's easy to go where there are a large number of concelebrants.
Right.
And find that some good-willed and presumably innocent priest has gone and taken ciboria from the tabernacle and put them, and then that ciboria, or ciborium, ciboria, depending on the circumstances, winds up being the Eucharist that's distributed to the concelebrant who are in the pews. It might not happen to the ones who are standing next to the bishop, but if you're, you know, in one of these 200,
right.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's a grave and serious abuse, and mostly out of ignorance, to be sure. But yeah.
Two questions. You started. I don't know if you finished this thought, but you said Vatican II failed to address three areas, and I don't think you mentioned one of the areas.
Okay. Well, the first, it failed to address in its documents first a moral theology. You know, it called for renewal. Veritatis Splenda supplies for moral theology. Secondly, it provided no apologetic, understood as a development of the preambula fidei. Now, other theologians will argue that the apologetic that the Second Vatican Council gives you, is a theological apologetic. This is the influence of Hans Urs von Balthasar. And the Pope seems to do the open your doors to Christ. There's something prima facie about the beauty of Christ representing him. But the classical apologetics, such as had been envisaged by the fathers, the whole history of the Church, and by the First Vatican Council, did not start from an intra-credal position, because they don't have an apologetic. You basically have to say, do you want to get in the circle with me? It's really nice in here, or not. And Fides et Ratio addresses that by recalling the power of reason that the Church has defined. You know, it is Catholic truth that the existence of God, I beg your pardon? It's the First Vatican Council citing anterior ones, yeah. The existence, but it's in Fides et Ratio, the existence of God, the immortality of the soul, which was a disputed point within Thomism, and something about human destiny that has to do with judgment. Take the three classic positions. So that's the second. And the third is the sacraments. You know, and this was the confusion. I mean, Sacrosanctum Concilium, there were many people, including my colleague Liam Walsh, who's a distinguished person and theologian, that he simply states in this thick book on the sacraments that liturgy is sacraments. And it's not, you know. And anyone that had classical instruction, you can go to the library and find some, maybe some of the fathers here had it. Anyone roughly in the seminary before my own days, which is to say 40 years ago or more, plus you had theses on sacramental theology. I mean, all the battles about physical causality and occasional causality and so on. These were the themes around which classical moral sacramental theology had developed, and all of that was put into Eclipse. And what you see, and then what in Ecclesia de Eucharistia is the beginning of the supply for that.
Yeah. Question. How much does Paul II get into the sacrificial nature of the Eucharist in Syrian?
Yeah, he mentions it, but I think he mentions the same text in Sacrosanctum Concilium. But it was not. That would be an interesting study. But and the Pope mentions it in Ecclesia Eucharistia. But the only thing you could conclude is Mysterium Fidei. Is it 68 or 69? I forget. Or 70? It's very no. It's the very late 60s. It didn't have a big effect. That's the only thing you can conclude. Yeah, it had more of an effect a little bit in stopping some of the transcendental epistemologies that Schillebeck's and others. So it put a little hold on things like transfinalization and transsignification. That it did. But it really took the catechism, in my judgment, people who wanted to displace transubstantiation, which is a very, you know, there's a good way of, in your catechism classes, the church can't get by without metaphysics, the church cannot get by without substance. There's no way, without an analogy of substance, you just can't get the kerygma across. It's got nothing to do with theology. And Paul VI was a little equivocal. He wasn't as sure. It was not until the catechism. I mean, he said something like, well, this is a venerable tradition or something. It wasn't until the catechism where you could say that the church had committed herself to transubstantiation. And I would argue it wasn't until Ecclesia Dei Eucharistia that you could really make the thing that say what I've just said here. Yeah, David, and then...
In a seminary very close to your heart and mine, 25 years ago, the only place we heard about priests as sacrificer and as Eucharist as sacrifice was in the Eucharistic courses themselves. We were specifically told that our primary job, by the rector, we were told our primary job was to preach. And then, of course, in field education, it was all basically the Protestant theology of personal ministry, etc. My question is,
yes, it's changed.
Yeah. Is it more integrally presented not only in the seminary close to your heart and mind, but throughout? Is there an effort to make it quite clear that wherever the priest is, that he's a sacrificer?
I don't know the answer to that, David, to be honest with you. That's why I wrote this paper, and it didn't seem it needs a little more work, but and I will see. I think people are skittish. And I think one of the implicit psychological reasons is that people know that the more this is emphasized, the more the feminine spirit will recoil. Because it's going to be very difficult. I mean, precisely because what the Pope describes as the feminine genius, its receptivity, its immediacy, it's life-giving, it's nourishing. What woman wants... Well, I mean, it's not funny. It really is. You have to, you know, to enter... For the priest, I mean, it's who we are. For the priest to enter in to the immolation, this takes, I would say, a man... Because the man is willing to surmount difficult challenges, such as, for example, war. It's the same thing that puts soldiers on the front lines of battlefields. They're willing to take substantial, even their own, sacrifice their own lives for something that transcends the common good. Now, I know you'll cite that women, that I understand, but it's just not the case that you're going, I think everyone knows this, mount a whole army of women to be on the front lines of anything that represents what we would call the equivalent, surely not the warfare of the First and Second World War, and not the warfare that we've seen in Iraq and Iran. It just isn't going to happen. And that has to do something with, there's something there that can be exploited, but people are skittish about it. Yeah. Father Ani. Well, I mean, the status, to take a Reinhard Hütte, first of all, you had in the United States this, what many theologians found to be impossible, namely a covenant of communion, ultimately between Lutherans and Zwingliites. And everybody knows, that's what set Luther and Zwingli apart, because for Zwingli, Zwingli had evacuated the Eucharist of all real meaning. It was, pure symbol. And now, what has happened, as I understand it, of course, as I quoted Jensen, in the Protestant, generally speaking, Protestant churches outside of very few so-called high Anglican circles, leaving them apart. In all of your Protestant circles, Reformed and Lutheran, breaking down whether it's Presbyterian or da-da-da-da-da, but I mean the two great traditions coming out of the 16th century Reform, Lutheran and Reform, symbolized by that union of Zwingliites and Lutherans. I mean, what you have is the Eucharist is something to do. I had to be so pejorative about it. So I mean, if in fact the quote-unquote celebration of it is increased, I don't know that, but if you tell me it is, then I assume it is, but it certainly is not increased, do anything such as we talked about here. And thirdly, one of the reasons that has led some of your high-profile Lutheran theologians and other Lutherans to convert is precisely the nonchalant way in which the quote-unquote Lord's Supper is celebrated, because Luther venerated the elements he had, whereas in the average Lutheran church, those elements are discarded once the Lord's Supper has terminated. Yeah, Roger.
Would you talk a little bit about the proactive and conscious participation of lay people in the Mass, Hoc Sacrificium Meum et Vestrum?
Yeah, well, that first of all should be put back, every translation of the Orate Fratres should reflect that your sacrifice and mine. Well, I mean, as you know, even Sacrosanctum Concilium speaks about full, active, and conscious according to your status, according to your station, according to your office in the church. I mean, the answer is simple, and it'll be a very difficult sell. But the first thing that needs to be said is what Trent says, and what St. Thomas says, namely, that the Eucharistic sacrifice is complete and self-sufficient in itself, and all you need is a Roman Catholic priest to celebrate the Mass. And this is, as it were, what a body is to the actions of a body. I mean, it's the difference between first and second perfection. Now, second perfection doesn't mean that there's something less excellent about the perfection. It simply means that in the order, the logical order, primum vivere, de in de agere. I mean, if you don't, agere sequitur esse, as you may recognize the thing. This is how the Mass and the fruits of the Mass, as they're called, and if you want to call it charity, move. First you have the Mass, and then you have the communication of the fruits of the Mass to the faithful, to the priest first, and then to the faithful. Now, this, of course, today I suspect would raise all sorts of objections that you can imagine and I don't have to repeat for you. But what needs to be explained is, and this is something, this could be an original thought, but you can use it to spoil the objection. What you need to understand and to teach to the people, first of all, is that the Eucharist itself is Christ's gift to the church. We want to, you know, he's not giving something to the church which is stingy and defective. But what is more important to point out to them is that this is the gift of new life. And therefore, what you have in the Eucharist is the sacramentalization of the priority of the divine initiative. In other words, it's the way in which God deals with us in all of our actions. God acts first, you know. Otherwise, we'd be, you know, none of us would be here, right? Now, this sacramentalization of the priority of the divine initiative is, of course, the very thing that the Reformation mistook. And you could even want to grant there were some historical reasons that occasioned it. They mistook that as, you know, the idle repetition, and sometimes meretricious, it must be said, repetition of masses. Well, it's not. You know, it never was. Okay, even if it was rather that the Mass was celebrated as a way of ensuring that in the world there existed an ex opere operato concretization, sacramentalization of God's grace, which is why in the Eucharist, unlike all the other sacraments, however you want to express this, the res et sacramentum, the abiding sacrament of the Eucharist, is not in us first, it's in the Eucharist. I mean, that's what we call real presence. Because of it, Ecclesia Dei Eucharistia, unity and charity flow in the church and become the res, and you could argue, when the church is perfected, that the Eucharist will give way, there's no Eucharist in heaven, and the unity and charity of the church now will be, quote-unquote, sacramentally, well, don't, we don't need sacraments anymore, but incarnated in the saints, please God, us among them. Now, when you see that, then the place of the any participant, including the priest, who, after all, remember, is not exempt. I mean, you might make the obvious statement, is not exempt himself from participating qua immolator and qua member, the church. So, you know, if I'm, let forget about mortals, and to make it simpler, let's just say something more likely. I'm lukewarm. Oh, you know, I'm lukewarm. Well, the res of the sacrament, you know, doesn't have special privileges for me because I'm a priest. But what qua priest, what I do, my lukewarmness, thanks be to God, according to God's conscious design, cannot detract from the sacramental incarnation or sacramentalization of the primacy of the divine initiative. The Mass is still there. I mean, this was, every Catholic schoolboy was taught this. There were novels about this, as the older fathers remember. I mean, every Catholic schoolboy, this is why you might want to give up a wife. You know, if you instead of, you know, having no other choice and figure it's a nice place to fall into. But, I mean, you might, when you see the importance, I mean, it seems to me that this, you know, this is what the kind of priestly, the vocation you want. You want someone who's willing to sacrifice potentialities, which differ according to the different vocations in the church, it should be added. You know, the Carthusian sacrifices potentialities more fully than a Dominican, for example. But anyway, it sacrifices certain potentialities, and in the Western Church, the discipline of celibacy is clear. Well, he does that because to go back to the language of gift, this sacrifice is of such utmost importance. And the way in which full conscious and active participation on the part of the laity is in this is that they become participants in the graces given. Thus, the burden is on them to ensure that they are not lukewarm and, please God, not unworthy and therefore eat unto their condemnation. Of course, we have terrible circumstances. You know, I mean, there are parishes in Boston, I've been told, you know, where there's up to 30 to 50 acknowledged gay couples who are participants in everything, and nobody, you know, no one wants to be unjust. And or divorced and remarried. I mean, that's when it implodes, and no one seems yet to want to make the connection that when you don't make them truly active, conscious participants, in the end they stop coming to church. You all go to Ask and Free, they just stop coming to church. So my phrase now is, call the real estate broker. You don't want to preach this? Call the real estate broker. Get the good one to make sure you get, I hate to say it, it's a little cynical, but read the pilot, you know. Yeah, fine. Is that, Roger, enough? Right. Yeah.
On the issue of the male priesthood,
right,
and the importance of a man offering sacrifice,
right,
it seems like the questioning of why only men can be priests, there's this sense that the priest masculinity is kind of arbitrary and meaningless. Can you say something about the meaningfulness of our masculinity, that it's revelatory? I mean, if the priest is the living and transparent image of Christ, and Christ was a man, and his masculinity is revelatory, it reveals something about God the Father, that we relate to God the Father as masculine.
I wouldn't use the word masculine and masculinity, because I think it's the wrong way. I think you'd simply say the church reserves priestly ordination to men. Now, the mimetic argument that you're citing, you know, there are two arguments inter in signores and ministeria ordinatio sacerdotalis. There are two arguments. One is the one you're citing, namely the fact that Christ was a man and the apostles were men. And the other is that this reveals the divine will. Those are the arguments. And I would say those are arguments which Catholics have to accept with Catholic and divine faith. They're non-traducible, non-negotiable. Now, the theologian comes and tries to discover something that would explain that, which is what you're asking me now, and which would in some way attempt to address the cultural ambiguities. So everyone knows that the complementarity of the sexes is a large-scale element of post-conciliar John Paul II magisterium. Then you go to see, you know, what is there within the male of the species that is characteristic, for reasons that we're not entirely sure, but nonetheless are, and are more or less verifiable by common sense, that may assist or may interpret this divine will, may help to explain. There are arguments of convenience, okay? There are arguments of convenience, because there's no way of getting beyond God's will. You can't get behind God's will to know why he only... it's what St. Thomas says. All you know is Christ came as a man. All you know is that the apostles, there were no women. Then from that, and it seems to me that there are two reasons for the male, and both of them have to do with transcendence. Now here you can cite, you know, ever so unlikely a figure, someone like Simone de Beauvoir, Sartre's mistress of the second sex. You know, I mean, there is a whole body of anthropological literature that shows that when you put men and women together, I mean, it's the men go out and hunt. I gave the example to Father Mullen, and I think it's a very good one. There is something, you know, about look at what happens about recruitment for military academies. And people, they want to, I say maybe some, you know, young men want to get in. Now I know he has young women. Look at recruitment in time of war. I mean, the Second World War. I only heard about it from my relatives. I mean, there was an enormous reaction on the part of the country. The young men, you know, fought to get down there and make sure, and some of them tried to hide defects to get into the the war. I mean, there's something in the male that prompts him, in this case, to exercise transcendence because he's willing to put, including himself, at risk for something that transcends the particular good. And women don't have it. That's as simple as that. And they don't have it not because they're defective. They don't have it because their task is imminence. You know? And anybody who has ever thought about dying, and that's one of the things about turning 60, you young fathers, I'll tell you, you begin to think about dying. Well, you don't want to die in the arms. You want a woman around for those last moments. I mean, if you have any common sense. I mean, it has to do, and then it has to do with birth and death and all of the things that we know about. So there's the transcendence and thus sacrifice. Sacrifice is transcendence, because especially self-sacrifice. But even sacrifice, even the sacrifice of privileged things such as the ram without a blemish. I mean, you know, why take the ram from the flock that would otherwise would give us milk and shear, what do you call it, fur, I mean, the wool. Why do this, you know? Well, you have to be a high priest to realize, yeah, we could get a lot of benefit out of this, but there's something bigger. This is religion, God, this, okay? So that's one. The second transcendence has to do with truth. This isn't said enough. And this is, I mean, the fathers were right. It is true. Canon law, we know. The first task of the priest is preaching because faith comes through preaching. And this is the difficult task. Who is to explain why the gay couples in these churches, A, should be receiving Holy Communion, and B, that their participation there has to be in some accommodated sense, that A, doesn't give scandal, and B, doesn't generate the impression that this is an alternate and acceptable Christian lifestyle, in the same way with divorce and remarriage and other things you can imagine. Well, no woman who's, that's, you know, if you go to the Catholic Theological Society of America, God preserve you from having to, but if you ever go, I mean, all for 20 years all you ever heard was Eucharistic hospitality. You know, you had all kinds of crazy things. I myself was at a mass when I was told I couldn't receive communion to everybody else because, and I simply refused. I said, no, that's not right. And they didn't like it. But I mean, the point is that the question of preaching, people, you know, don't want to preach truths that cut. You know, that's the bind we're in. But it's a losing game. It's a losing game because the moral life, that's the reason why I put in there the connection between Eucharist and fraternal communion. The Pope puts it, it's very important. You can't have love in a sin-marked world without sacrifice. You cannot have it. And that means that the sinner is taken care of in a way other than the one who is not a sinner, no matter how badly that person's feelings are hurt. And it takes a man to do that. Some women, believe me, I mean, take what now, if you don't know, is one of the big, we know we've had several high-ranking theologians, including members of the prelature, I regret to say, in St. Jose Maria's house, but also cardinals, Dominican cardinals, aver that condoms have a place in the Christian world and Christian sexual activity. And the place has to do, of course, with marriage and with health prevention measures. Now, without commenting on the two men whom I referred to, undoubtedly they are men and they had reasons that they would consider very justifiable, but by and large, when you hear the people who want to talk about condoms in AIDS infected, there's no transcendence at work. And the reason why, the minute at the church, you know, just say there's one little place where you'll have people coming out of the walls, because they know that this has signaled what everybody wants, namely sex. You know, let's kill the Pope so we can have more sex. It's true. Now, who is to stand out? You can do the social sciences. You can find Green's book on AIDS prevention and show that there are studies that show the more you give out condoms, the higher the rate of AIDS goes. You can get all that sociological stuff. But in the end, it has to be a man who stands up and defends what the normative teleology of the coital act is, to cut to the chase. So, to go back to your question, why is the man a priest? I think in addition to what is being said in Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, you have two further arguments, and these arguments are alluded to, they're not as developed as much as I've done them here, by Father Benedict Ashley in a book that has been universally ignored, and that is a book called Justice in the Church, which was the fruit of the McGivney lectures given at the John Paul II Institute when it first started up in Washington. And it's the only book I know that attempts to do what I'm doing in a rather slim way, namely to provide arguments why it is justice in the church. It's still available from CUA, paperback. It never got reviewed, nobody looked. It got, and of course, the reason is that Ashley is a good apologist. He's a good theologian, and he came up with some arguments that were difficult. You know, they simply had to be ignored. Invite me back next year after the visitation, and we'll talk about that. There's a visitation, as you know, that's going to begin in the fall, an apostolic visitation, which is ordered only to inquire and refer, ad inquirendum et ad referendum. It's not to resolve. And the two issues, the teaching of moral theology, especially in sexual ethics, this I think is well known, George Weigel had an article, and also the question of training for what is euphemistically referred to as training for celibacy. At the Institute for the Psychological Sciences in Alexandria, some of you may know it, we've begun to do some research. There's an enormous amount of data on the question of homosexuality. Enormous. And the only thing we've learned so far from having done, we had research assistants, I haven't been doing this. One thing that it seems has been demonstrated, there's no agreement. There is no agreement on the answer to the question, who or what is a homosexual? No agreement. And this includes people who are nuanced, shall we say, for lack of a better term. So it's not going to be easy. I don't think there's an easy answer. And the high-end establishment, we had Robert Coles and Bardsley, who's his successor, who's the chief of psychiatric medicine at Boston Children's Hospital, for a whole day, a morning with Bosley, who's actually in practice, and then the doyen, Robert Coles, he came in, like he just had stopped chopping down trees or something. But he had, he's a kind of mythic and mystic figure. Neither would allow, even entertain, whether children are better served by one parent, parents of complementary sexes, or parents of the same sex. Ruled out, absolutely none. There's nothing to be said. It is assumed that whatever judgments are going to be made are without reference to those facts, both of them. Now, there are 300 children in the emergency psychiatric ward of Boston's Children's Hospital. 300 children in an emergency ward. This is not just the little depression treated with, these are children that have sat there presumably for very dramatic symptoms. But nothing would be said. So I don't see anything coming down from above. Certainly, we've seen that Paul McHugh, who's, you know, one of the defenders of children from priestly malpractice, has just come out in favor of cloning for therapeutic purposes, arguing falsely, to my mind, that unless you really fiddle, quote unquote, with this, you know, it won't become a human being, and therefore you have 2 weeks to play with it. That's McHugh. So there's Johns Hopkins, and under him is Berlin. Now, if you can't be, as the St. Thomas shows, if you can't be trusted with life, you most likely are not going to be trusted with sex, because the natural law, you know, works up. So the bottom line is, I wish I could say something more intelligent. All I can say is, at the moment, there are no clear indications coming from the psychological science, and you can read America to discover what the theologians are saying. Okay, thank you very much.